Hi, this is Ben Hutchins with Avery Productions. I'm trying a little test here. I like doing voice work. I do a weekly advertising spot for the newspaper I work for on the local radio station, and I like books on tape. I listen to them in the car all the time. So I decided to try my own audiobook-style production to see how it came out and see if people liked it, and maybe practice for some voice work down the road. I've selected this piece pretty much at random, after blowing a couple of hours fooling around with the beginnings of different bits, just because I like it, and I wanted to do a test and see how it went. I have a message from another time. Avery Productions Unlimited presents Undocumented Features Future Imperfect, Symphony of the Sword, Number 1, Hogtown Rhapsody, by Benjamin D. Hutchins. 10:13 p.m. Eastern Time, Saturday, February 26th, 2405, I-90 westbound, Canandaigua, New York, Earth. It was unseasonably warm for late February. The winter of 2404-2405 was fading early and fast, and the night sky over upstate New York was clear and splashed with stars. Even unseasonably warm isn't all that warm in New York State in February, though. The temperature stood at 40 or so degrees Fahrenheit, warm enough that what little snow remained was melting, but not exactly shorts weather. Which made it all the more unusual, on the face of it, that the antique Impala convertible that was currently heading west on Interstate 90 had its top down. Utena Tenjo sat in the passenger seat of that Impala, leaning back with her right arm hanging over the side of the car, and marveled at it, as she had all night. Here she was, riding in an open car in February, the wind ruffling her hair and the sleeves of her jacket, and she was just as warm and comfortable as if it were a pleasant summer night. Caitlin Hutchins, whose car it was, had tried to explain it to her, but she'd gotten as far as multiphasic field containment system before Utena had told her never mind. All that mattered was that, as long as the little green light on the dash next to the radio stayed lit, a bubble of space extending to about an arm's length from all sides of the car stayed warm. Utena knew this last part because, if she raised her hand above her head and stretched a little bit, the tips of her fingers would suddenly tingle as if she'd touched them to ice water, and when she drew them back they'd be cold against her face. The field also damped the noise of the wind enough that their conversation was possible at a comfortable level. Since leaving Ballston Lake, where they'd stopped at Lakeside Farms for dinner, the fivesome and the Impala had traveled in relative silence. Each was absorbed with his or her own thoughts, listening to the music that Kate and Utena cycled into and out of the stereo system, and generally savoring the fact that classes were out for 2 weeks, and they were heading for a magical and exotic land where everything was better. Utena turned a little in her seat to look into the back. Miki Kaoru, seated behind Kate, seemed to be asleep. R. Dorothy Wainwright, who sat straight and uncomplaining in the middle, looked back at her with the faintest of smiles, and Kyoichi Sionji was sprawled out in his third of the spacious back seat, his arm flung across behind Dorothy, looking up at the sky with a dreamy expression on his lean, narrow face. Utena smiled a bit at the sight of him. Who would have thought that Sionji could even have that look on his face, let alone that Utena would find herself pleased to see it some day? He seemed to notice her watching him. His eyes snapped back into focus, and he raised his head, grinning sardonically. "This is a strange feeling," he said. "The last time I rode in a convertible..." He glanced across Dorothy at Miki, who had roused from his nap with the start of a conversation and was looking curiously at him. "Well, you had that amusing experience too, didn't you, Kaoru?" Miki gave him a blank look. "I don't..." he said, then blinked and looked faintly troubled. "Oh," he said, "yes, that was... different." Then he smiled, looked up at the sky, and said, "Very different indeed." Utena gave them both a puzzled look, then seemed to put it together. "Oh, let's not go anywhere near there tonight, huh? I'm in a good mood, and I don't want to ruin it." "I hear that," said Sionji. Subject dropped. "It's a beautiful night," said Dorothy, following Miki's gaze upward. "You can see so much more without city lights around." "Yes," said Miki. "Indeed," said Sionji. Utena giggled a bit at the sight of all three of them sitting in almost identical positions, hands folded on chests, faces upturned. Under most circumstances, she tended not to find astronomy all that amusing, but this was so very different. She smiled and turned to face the driver. "How are you holding up?" she asked. Fine, Kate replied with a grin. She was relaxed behind the controls, one hand atop the wheel, her left arm along the top of the door, her very slightly curly brown hair blowing behind her in the wind. She glanced across at her roommate, the dash lights reflecting from her glasses, purring like a kitten. Mmm, said Utena, settling back into her seat and stretching her fingertips up into the cold air again. Wish we could have brought Nall with us. So does Nall, Kate replied, and they shared a laugh. The car prowled smoothly onward through the night, its occupants conversing about this and that, falling silent periodically to listen to the music and enjoy the emptiness of the road. At one point they broke the fugue section of an old Sabotage song up between them, and had a fine time with it, though Dorothy rightly observed that Sionji had a hard time keeping to his own line's meter. I believe that situations all depend on circumstance, in a fugue. Oh, Caitlin? Yes? Did you bring the rehearsal recordings from Thursday? This is a vacation, Mickey. I know, but did you? Well, yes. You guys are obsessed. This isn't obsession. I felt obsession. This is just strong interest. Hey, come on, Sionji, don't get all philosophical. And for God's sake, button your shirt, will ya? I don't need to see your scrawny chest every time I turn around to talk to Miki. Oh? Having difficulty controlling yourself, Tenjo? When we get out of this car, you are so dead. Just for laughs, let's see what's on the radio in Rochester. Or not. Yeah. What was that? The Thruster Busters, Super Sexual Destruction Imperative, first single from their 2231 debut album, Bust a Thruster. The experimental jizz fusion Digiwhale with reggae, punk rock, and Antarian sklunge influences. Sounded more like somebody torturing a cat underwater to me. The comparison is apt. They have also been compared to an unfiltered hyperpulse signal, only not as tonal. Ooh, that's a good one. Yeah, Miki, that's good. Perfect. I think we could do that one in concert sometime. I don't know. Get up on stage and sing? I'm used to being behind a piano. Go ahead, Miki, join the band. You'll have girls lining up, if they can get past Azalin. I do love the way he blushes. Yeah, he's almost as cute as Corwin. Sionji? Yeah. Standing up is dangerous. Right. Hey, Kate? Yes, Utena? Does your car have a name yet? Not yet. I haven't thought of a good one yet. How about Vlad? Vlad? The Impala. Oh, Dorothy, that's awful. Ow. You should be ashamed of yourself, Miss Dorothy. I'm not sure I want you to develop a sense of humor if it's going to be that bad. Corwin was right. There's just no pleasing some people. They reached the Canadian border at 12:30, pulling up to the tollbooth-like customs station with the music silenced. Five young people in an open, Atma-shielded convertible in the middle of the night, and the driver stuttered. Caitlin figured the odds were about 1 in 100 they wouldn't be asked to pull to the side and show an RCMP officer through their luggage. "Evening," said the customs officer in the booth. "Good evening," said Caitlin. Then, with a sigh, she gestured to Utena. Hi, said Utena. Sorry about this. Kate has kind of a problem talking to strangers. Grunted the officer, whose name tag read Rivers. He gave Caitlin a compassionate smile and added, Bummer. Caitlin nodded with a, yeah, it's a pain, expression and an eloquent shrug. Citizenship? Asked Officer Rivers. Zeta Cygni, said Utena. That's for everybody? Yep. Okay. Where are you coming from on Earth? Worcester, Mass, she replied. We're students at Worcester Prep Institute. All of you? Yep. Okay. Purpose for visiting Canada? Vacation in Toronto, Utena told him. The statement brought a smile to his thin, blue-jowled face. Sounds like you've been there before. Once last year, said Utena. We caught Game 7. Had so much fun we decided to come back for spring break. Lucky you, said Rivers. I watched it on TV. Hey, I think maybe I saw you. I thought you looked familiar. Utsuna wondered if he was hitting on her. Yeah, sure, pal. 45,000 people at that game, you saw me on TV. But maybe he was just being nice. Anyway, said Rivers, how long will you be staying? A week. We're headed back next Saturday. Any weapons? Two swords. We're licensed. Caitlin and Utsuna handed over the paperwork. Rivers looked it over. WPI duelists, huh? Didn't know any American schools had those anymore. As far as we know, we're the only one. You up here for a tournament or something? No, just fun, but we have to keep in training. Fair enough, said Rivers, returning their papers. Any meats or fruits? No. Anything to declare? Utsuna stopped. Dorothy was raising her hand. Oh, duh, sorry. Dorothy here is a robot. Rivers raised an eyebrow. Really? She's the most realistic-looking one I've ever seen. I'd never have known. Thank you, said Dorothy. Are you Turing certified? Rivers asked her. No, Dorothy replied. Whose are you? Corwin Ravenhair of New Avalon, Caitlin's brother, she said, indicating the driver. Kate smiled and waved. Caitlin is my custodian here on Earth. You have the paperwork for that? Said Rivers to Kate. Sure, she replied. Hang on. She took out her wallet, extracted the red-edged certificate from it, then handed it over. Rivers read it, nodded, and handed it back. Do you have any built-in weapons or defensive systems? He asked Dorothy. No, Dorothy replied. The first law... Okay, said Rivers, holding up a hand with a smile. I have to ask. I understand. Okay, kids, you're all set, said the customs agent, tabbing the control on his panel that raised the barrier from in front of the Impala. Have a great time in Toronto. Thanks, said Kate with a grin. She put the car in gear, let out the clutch, and off they went. Wow, said Utsuna as Caitlin found her way to the Queen Elizabeth Way. That was cool. I thought for sure they were going to search us. Maybe he was intimidated by Sionji's mighty chest, said Kate with a smile. Hmm? Said Sionji, raising his head. Someone say my name? You slept through customs? Utsuna demanded. Customs? We're in Canada? Yes! Then I guess I did. Sionji yawned, stretched, and reached one long arm across the seat behind Dorothy to joggle Mickey's shoulder. What about you, Kaworo? Did you sleep through customs too? Huh? Said Mickey, blinking. Did you say something, Sionji? You guys! Said Utsuna, amazed. Cut us some slack, Tenjo, said Sionji. Route 62 was boring. Maybe if you'd managed to find the bridge the falls can be seen from. Well, I'm sorry. I got the routes mixed up. We'll see them on the way back, okay? Sionji smiled. Okay, Tenjo, don't get your shorts in a knot. I was only joking. He looked thoughtful, then added, Route 62 was boring, though. At least we didn't come across Grand Island, said Kate. Blech. Hey, Dorothy, Utsuna mused a few minutes later, as the Impala was lunging up to cruising speed on the open stretch of the QEW. Yes, Dorothy said. Did you lie to the customs guy back there? No, Dorothy replied. But you started to tell him about the first law. I never said I was subject to it, Dorothy replied piously. I cannot be held accountable for the unwarranted inferences of humans. Utsuna blinked at her, then grinned. No, I guess you can't, she replied, then turned back to the front. Unbelievable, she murmured, shaking her head with a fond smile. She glanced at Kate, who grinned and said nothing. They rounded the toe of Lake Ontario on an all-but-deserted QEW, passing by the lights of Hamilton and admiring the lake from the vantage point of the very high bridge near there, bathed in the light of the nearly full moon. Dorothy took a few pictures of it. They growled along the Great Wall of Mississauga, past the Motel 6, where the Art of Noise had spent a very odd night, Kate and Utsuna passing each other a silent smile in the front seat as both remembered a private moment from that place, and at last the gleaming majesty of Toronto appeared before them. Utsuna hadn't really seen it like this when they'd arrived last time. Moose's van wasn't much of a vantage point for things straight ahead if you were sitting in one of the passenger seats. On a beautiful clear night in an open convertible, though, it was like being in a holotheater. She noticed that, where New Avalon shone with a soft, warm golden light, Toronto had a cooler, more silvery look to its night glow, a light that blended well with the shining near full moon to make the whole thing look vaguely ethereal, as though its towers and lights would disappear if a cloud crossed the moon. Only the scarlet pinpricks of the aircraft lights on the tall buildings, and the running lights of air cars and airships lent any color to the skyline. It didn't have the grandeur of New Avalon, but that moonlit glow had its own impressiveness.
"Wow," she said.
"Mmm," said Kate, grinning.
"It's beautiful," Mickey murmured.
"That it is," Sionji agreed. Toronto is only the 100th most beautiful city in the Federation, according to...
"Have you no poetry in your soul, R. Dorothy?"
said Sionji expansively. He put his arm around her shoulders, gestured to the city with his free hand, and said, "Does this vista not touch your heart? Is its relative beauty so important when it's the only one before your eyes?"
Utan turned around in her seat to give him a very puzzled expression.
"What do you want?" he grumbled. "I'm tired."
"You make a valid argument, Mr. Sionji," said Dorothy. "I don't wish to debate whether I have a soul or heart at the moment, but nevertheless, your point is taken. It is quite lovely."
"And I," said Caitlin, "am quite hungry."
"It's almost 2 a.m, said Mickey.
"So it is," said Kate. She turned a sly smile to Utana.
"And you know what that means."
"Happy 7, the roommates chorused. Well, more or less. Happy 7 was a small restaurant on Spadina Avenue in Toronto's Chinatown, a bit south of the university. Kate pulled the Impala to the curb in front of the restaurant, then got out and took a careful look at the curb and the signage on that block to make sure it was actually legal to park there. The coast appeared to be clear, so she got back into the car and put the top up. Once everybody was out, she stood back and pressed the red button on the little key fob remote that had accompanied the keys. There was a soft, almost apologetic honk from the Impala's horn, and for the briefest of instants, the skin of the car seemed to shimmer like oil dripped onto the surface of water. Smiling with satisfaction, Kate flipped the keys back into her hand and pocketed them, and the 5 entered the restaurant.
"Oh my goodness," Mickey said as they crossed the threshold.
"Yes," said Sionji, equally stunned.
Happy 7 had the kitschiest decor either young man had ever seen.
The restaurant was fairly small and narrow, with room for 2 rows of round tables with an aisle in between leading back to the kitchen and restrooms. The ceiling was festooned with brightly colored plastic light fixtures, which were garish replicas of Chinese paper lanterns. The walls were covered with pinkish-orange wallpaper, and over that, various bright prints with large Chinese characters and stylized images of people eating. There was a fat, smug-looking Lucky Cat statue on the little counter next to the cash register, in front, and several equally fat and smug-looking plastic Buddhas.
"Budai?"
wondered Mickey, scattered here and there in niches and on pedestals throughout the dining room. The tables had pink plastic tablecloths, and the napkins were folded into little tulip shapes and stuffed into the empty water glasses.
"Hi, how you?" asked the smiling hostess. 5, this way, please."
She peered at Utana.
You be here before?"
"Huh? Yeah, a couple of times," Utana replied, somewhere between puzzled and impressed.
"Last year?"
"I thought so," said the hostess. "You Red Sox fans, right? Come here after big game."
"Yeah, that's right," said Utana, now just impressed. "Wow, how'd you remember us?" The hostess grinned and touched her own black hair.
"It's your hair," she said. "How often you see that color? You were with real big guy that time, too, and a blue girl, and a little short girl who eat like a horse. Not easy to forget that bunch, huh?"
Utana was forced to admit that she had a point. "I see you are still leaving your mark on the world everywhere you go, Tenjo," Sionji observed dryly after the hostess had left them with their menus. Utana grinned at him. "Some girls got it." "The last person she mentioned must have been Azalin," said Mickey with a smile.
"Yup," said Kate. "She slammed down 2 orders of mushy chicken and a large pork lo mein."
"Not counting the stuff she filched from everybody else's plate," Utana added. "I think she boosted a whole egg roll off Devlin's plate with her tail."
Devlin never finishes his egg rolls anyway," said Kate with a dismissive gesture.
"I wonder how his trip to Gamelon is going," Dorothy wondered. Kate checked her watch. "By now, he's probably in bed." She smiled slyly and added, "Whether he's asleep is an open question." Mickey went a trifle pink and busied himself with his menu.
"Man," said Utana, "now there's a relationship that I don't get at all."
"Love turns up in unexpected places sometimes," Sionji mused.
Yeah, that's true,
Utina agreed, nodding thoughtfully.